Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I am Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Andrew Ng, co-founder Coursera, director Stanford Artificial Intelligence Lab, and a world-renowned, top-ranking, distinguished researcher, innovator, and entrepreneur. Andrew, you've just got a remarkable background. You produce such outstanding research and innovation, which are really impacting the world. So thank you for coming in today and sharing all of your experiences with our audience.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Now, Andrew, let's start off by asking some questions about your most recent roles and research interests. And you do so much. You've done so much in terms of machine learning, artificial intelligence, deep learning, and so forth for various corporations and so on. And also you have this Coursera company. Now, in terms of your research, what are the big research questions in machine learning and artificial intelligence, and what are the ways or processes for answers?
You know, I think the field of AI, the field of deep learning specifically, which I've been working in, has been taking off like crazy. Over the last few years, the number of academic research papers on deep learning on basically massive neural networks has been rising faster than almost anything else I've seen. And in industry too, you know, Google, Facebook, Microsoft, many other companies are either building up their own significant deep learning teams or sometimes acquiring companies for their deep learning expertise. And so I think this is a discipline that's having tremendous impact both within academia as well as on industry. Having said that, despite being at the center of some of this activity, I feel like many parts of deep learning are still wide open and we don't really know where the field is going to go. So I think that but in domains where you don't have labeled data, I think there's a lot of very inspiring ideas about how to have deep learning algorithms just, you know, watch YouTube videos, not have you told anything, but just watch videos or listen to sounds and discover patterns in the world by yourself. And I think there's a tremendous potential, but a lot of that potential is still not yet proven out. So I'm actually super excited about that set of ideas.
You know, it's interesting. I had a discussion with Tom Mitchell, and he talked about his NEL project, that never-ending language learner. And I guess Carnegie Mellon also has their NEL project. And the ramifications of that, you know, he's saying maybe in 10 years you're going to have the system being able to completely consume what's on the web. Do you think it's going to get in that direction where we're going to have this sort of really useful, almost human-like capabilities that are on the web?
You know, here's the interesting thing. I think Tom Mitchell's work is really inspiring. His vision of a continuous learning software is inspiring. And I think that today there are software algorithms that are consuming, let's say, a significant fraction of the English text on the internet. and I think even though these algorithms today are consuming far more text than any human could possibly read in their entire lifetime, our software today still falls far below, you know, human levels of performance in terms of understanding certain aspects of the world. There are some things that computers vastly outperform humans just by dint of the sheer amount of text they've consumed. But in terms of reasoning about the world and, you know, real human-level AI, despite getting far more data or text or images or audio than any human could possibly, you know, get in their entire lifetime, our software still falls short. And so to me, this is a sign that we don't have the right algorithms yet, because whatever, you know, humans do, we learn to be much more intelligent with much less data. So I think that at some point, we will actually run out of text to consume, because all of humanity, all of the internet has generated, frankly, only actually a finite amount of text. And I think that there will be increasing pressure to come up with better algorithms.
Now, what are some of the controversies in your field and why?
Yeah, you know, so deep learning is very exciting, and one of the confusions or in the discipline is that deep learning, the term deep learning encompasses really two ideas. The first idea is let's call it supervised learning, in which if you have a lot of labeled data, these algorithms are fantastic at soaking up the labels to make accurate predictions. And so, for example, if you have, let's say, millions of users are clicking on web pages, and you want to predict if they'll click on a web page or not, if they click on an ad or not, then deep learning algorithms can be applied to these massive data sets of who clicked on what ad in order to predict who will click on what ads in the future. And so that's supervised learning, because you have labels, or if you have lots of images and you want to recognize objects, but you have thousands or tens or hundreds of thousands of labeled images of cars and motorcycles and roads, you can make very good predictions using deep learning algorithms. So, but there's a second, not really unrelated, but there's a second body of ideas in that also goes by the term deep learning that is very different, which is, can you get a piece of software to watch YouTube for hours on end, or can you get a piece of software to read text on the internet, or listen to audio for hours on end, and without you telling it anything, without you tagging any data or labeling any data, to have it figure things out for itself. So one of the maybe somewhat celebrated results in this latter part of the deep learning world is that, was it about a year and a half ago, only 2 years ago, the Google team that I was leading had developed a deep learning algorithm that watched YouTube for a week and had discovered by itself the concept of cat. And the cool thing was, no one had ever told it what a cat was. It's just that there's a lot of cats on YouTube, and by watching YouTube had discovered the concept of a cat by itself. But I think that the second unsupervised learning, learning from unlabeled or from untagged data, is maybe more human-like. I think that most humans learn primarily from unlabeled data. And I think this has tremendous potential. This unsupervised learning idea has tremendous potential for letting us make a lot of progress in machine perception. But it tends to be confused with the supervised learning aspects of it, which is what is really driving a lot of the, let's say, economic value of deep learning today. So I think that many of us, many guys, including myself, maybe did a few of the disservice by, commingling these two, because it's easier to talk about them as though it's one idea. But I think we're only just realizing that these are, two related but also somewhat separate, somewhat distinct ideas. And that while in the short term, the labeled data stuff is working really well, if we want to, maybe have a hope of making a little bit of progress towards real AI, making real progress in perception, I think the aspect of learning from unlabeled data is something we will need to focus on.
This kind of I find really intriguing. So do you see some value then applied to the deep learning work where, like Judy O'Pearl's work with Bayesian networks and then counterfactuals and then the sort of causal calculus that he created, and he's doing a lot of evangelizing about this kind of mathematical model that he's created and in some way being applied with deep learning, or you think it's just too far apart?
I've been wrong about these predictions so many times, it's always hard to say. My instinct is that the world is so complicated that our attempts to manually encode little pieces like counterfactuals or graphical models with specific graphical structures, that the world is so complex, my instinct is to try to select incredibly flexible learning algorithms and let the learning algorithms examine data from the world and let the learning algorithms sort out, what is true and what is not true about the world for itself. And so my instinct has steered away from that body of work, but it'd be interesting to see how the maybe more traditional or the logical the reasoning aspects and deep learning algorithms could come together someday.
Now, you've already talked about some of the practical applications, so I'm going to just mine that even further, and that is, in the work that you do, what are the practical applications for, let's say, 2015 or 16, and how does it impact things like business in some way, or government, or media, education, and society?
Let's see. So I think because of the work of the major tech companies using deep learning, many of us are already using deep learning algorithms. I think probably in industry today, I would guess that the two companies with the most advanced deep learning teams are probably Google and Baidu. Baidu's the number one search engine in China. I think that, my team, actually when I was working at Google, my team had worked with the speech recognition team to improve the Android speech recognition system. And so today, speech recognition on every Android cell phone runs on top of, you know, deep learning software that my team had helped build. Similarly for other applications throughout Google, throughout Baidu, throughout other tech companies, I think machine learning touches so many aspects of our lives. And I think what some of these organizations have done is create deep learning tools to broadly empower engineers throughout their organizations in order to apply deep learning algorithms to many, many different problems. So I like to tell people that most of us use machine learning algorithms, you know, dozens of times a day without knowing it, ranging from the spam filter, which is fundamental to just keeping our email system working, to, you know, face detection for the various solo applications, to every time you use your credit card, you know, there's a learning algorithm checking if your credit card has been stolen. And it was really you making that credit card purchase. And what we're seeing is that sometimes behind the scenes, sometimes not behind the scenes, increasingly deep learning algorithms are taking over, you know, or being used to these slivers of to these different applications.
You know, I was fascinated by the DARPA robotic challenge that occurred late last year, and it continues this year. And it sort of gives a picture of where things are going. So, in your opinion, then, what will computers and robots look like by 2020?
Gosh, you know, I actually have no idea. For a long time, my students and I, at Stanford students and I, have been struggling a bit, have been trying to figure out what are the next killer apps of robotics. And I think that I'm seeing a lot of activity in robotics here in Silicon Valley, and it's only in the last 2 or 3 years that there have been, you know, far more robotic startups than in the previous, you know, 3 or 5 or 10 years. But I really don't know where it's going to go. I see really exciting work in people producing low-cost robots for manipulation, which is fantastic for researchers. I see a lot of work in telepresence robots. I recently got a Beam robot myself from Suitable Technologies, and I actually love using the thing. But there are various companies building telepresence robots that let you log into a remote robot, drive it, and, you know, go to a meeting in your friend's office even when you're across on the other side of the country. So because I travel some amount, it's actually very convenient when I can log into my Beam robot, drive it to one of my students' offices, and have a meeting with them, even if I'm somewhere else in the country. I think there's fascinating work in agricultural robotics. It's a company called Blue River that is doing very cool work on, they tell me that if you eat lettuce in the United States, there's a 3% chance that the lettuce you ate, you know, was tended by one of their robots already. And so I think there are, I see a lot of robotics work attacking different verticals, relatively narrow vertical applications, which means that the robots are often tailored, built specifically for that vertical. But the creativity and diversity and the shapes and sizes of these robots it feels like it's blowing up. It feels like it's growing rapidly. So I find that very exciting. But I want to just put out there, though, I think this is all, short term, you know, as in like maybe 2 or 3 or 5 year transformations of computers and robotics. Over the longer term, there's this body of ideas that I'm still really excited about, which is, instead of, you know, working on these algorithms to get whatever 1 or 3 or 5 or 10 or 20% improvements, can we make broader strides towards perception? So one thing I realized a few years ago, when we were working on the STAIR, Stanford AI Robot project that wound up launching ROS with Google Garage, was that today we can already build robots that are mechanically capable of doing almost anything, almost all the household tasks we want them to do, say, like, you know, tidy up your house, things like that. And the reason we don't have these robots in the houses today is because we don't know how to write the software, and especially the perception software, also planning and so on, but I feel like especially the perception software in order to understand what's really in the houses. And I think that if we want to make progress towards, let's say, truly intelligent robots, it's hard to say this, you know, being careful not to overhype the science, but in order to make just a little bit of progress towards, like, AI or towards truly intelligent perception, I think there's tremendous potential in deep learning algorithms, especially the unsupervised versions of deep learning algorithms. And so I'm hoping to I hope that various research groups, mine and others, will be able to make progress on that.
Now, I guess this part is maybe controversial in the sense that, you know, there's varying opinions of Kurzweil and this idea of singularity, and do you support it in any way, or you just think it's just too far out?
I think the popular press notion of the singularity is really far out, and I think that there has been a bit of a froth for a little bit of hype surrounding that, that I think is mismatched with what I see happening in the science. I mean, I think that AI has tremendous potential. I think that in the coming 5 or 10 years, we'll make tremendous progress in perception, and I hope that deep learning will play a huge part of that. But I think the discussion of the singularity, I don't think it is serving the science well, and I think it is far further out than, you know, than the impression some of popular media sometimes conveys.
Okay, now let's go to maybe one of your favorite topics, and this is about online education and MOOCs specifically. And I did a Crunchbase search on Coursera, and I think you raised about $85 million, something like that, and some notable investors who are supporting what you're trying to do. So let's talk about Coursera. You're a founder of Coursera with Daphne. And can you overview your projections for 2015, the key KPIs of success for Coursera?
Yeah, so I'll just tell you a couple things we care a lot about. One is growth. I think that, you know, Coursera today has 7 million learners from all around the world, but the world has 7 billion people, and we want to give everyone access to great education. So there's a lot of room there to grow, and this feeds into our work on mobile, like Android and iOS apps, to let learners access Coursera. Because it turns out, if we want to reach into the developing economy, there are many users that can afford a smartphone, but maybe have intermittent network access. And so if we can release an Android app, you know, that runs on like a 20 or a 40 US dollar Android tablet, which are starting to go on sale in India, for example. And if we learned that it tends to be the poorest people in a society that tends to have intermittent network access or have the longest train or bus commute times. And so we hope to have an app that, you know, they can download for free, that they can then travel to sometimes a village center or travel to a library where they can have internet access for a few hours, download all the video content onto their mobile device so that they then consume the content during their relatively longer commutes. A second one is credential value. So what we're seeing is that more and more learners around the world are taking credentials that they're earning from taking Coursera MOOCs and listing them in their resume and using them to find better employment opportunities. Recently I was speaking with a Coursera learner, Zach Stairsdor, that at the age of 25 had decided he didn't like his job in an investment firm. So he quit his job, spent the next 5 months studying various free online resources, Coursera MOOCs, other free online content, and at the end of that, he listed the certificates he had earned on his resume, and today he has found a much better job doing data science, working for Columbia's Teachers College. And if not for the MOOCs he had taken, you know, he would not have been able to pivot his career. And so we're seeing a flood of those stories today of learners taking MOOCs, earning certificates, and then employers meeting them and offering them better employment opportunities. And so another thing we're tracking is the degree to which employers, I guess, understand the value of these MOOC credentials. And we're seeing that grow rapidly already, but I hope that this will continue to grow throughout the next couple of years.
You know, this the whole concept of MOOCs is still controversial, though. I mean, I keynoted on it the last few years, and I actually pointed to your work at Coursera. In fact, there was an economic forum in Astana, and I talked about it a couple of times. And, you know, there's people who kind of rally behind it and say it's just sort of the greatest thing that's ever happened, and others who say it's sort of an old story. And, you know, where's the kind of the meat in that burger sort of idea? You know, like, What are your feelings about that controversy, or do you think it's just a transition point?
Yeah, so let's see. What's new about MOOCs, right? So one thing, and as I say, MOOCs are new. There's a lot of problems. We don't have the user experience right. We're not out of the woods yet. I think it's still early, and we still have, you know, more questions than answers. Having said that, I think it is new. And what is new is scale. So a lot of people say that online education has been around for a long time. This is just online education. What's new? What is new is scale. And I think, you know, back in 2011 when I guess four students and I launched two of the first MOOCs out of Stanford that later became Coursera, the project that later became Coursera, what we had done, really our frankly pretty narrow focus was on how to develop a piece of software so that no matter how many students sign up, we can still give every student a great experience. So traditional online education had, you know, student-faculty ratios of maybe 20 to 1 or 50 to 1, and MOOCs today have student-faculty ratios of maybe, right, 40,000 to 1. My course was 100,000 to 1. And I think the ability to deliver these highly scalable forms of education, I think it dramatically changes the economics of education. There's still a large upfront cost to producing the course content, but once you've done it, the incremental cost of signing up one more student is effectively zero. And so that's the change. Having said that, you know, I think the student experience isn't good enough. We haven't figured out the pedagogy, the software product, our platform, the website needs a lot of work. So I think that I think it's still very early days.
So, you know, it's clear that there could be some value to education. And as I mentioned, I've been sort of speaking on it. And you talked about some of that. How about to business or government or society? What are the value to those segments?
Yeah, you know, let me answer society, or what's the value of this to society? I mean, I think in its broader sense, I think of an education as giving you superpowers. I think that with an education, you can learn to write software, right? You can teach other people. You can learn to cook healthier food for your children. With an education, you will live a longer life. We know that to be true. So I think what we had created, the five of us, like 3 years ago had developed was technology that enables universities to give people superpowers at scale. And I think that there's tremendous potential to give individuals much better opportunities. I would love to give every person on this planet a shot at a middle-class life. I think in an education, I think, is key to that. And at a societal level, I think that we can, you know, maybe accelerate the progress of our civilization. Many governments are looking to MOOCs as a way to level up their population's skill set. I think, you know, if you look at economic progress, one of the best predictors of economic progress is how educated is your society. I mean, so there's actually PISA rankings, the international standardized score rankings are actually predictive of a country's economic growth, and I think governments realize that and are thinking through how to use MOOCs for education. And as for businesses, you know, today's world changes rapidly, and most of us in computing, right, are working on programming languages that literally did not exist back when we were in college, and in computing, but also in other disciplines. The world today changes so fast that all of us need regular infusions of knowledge in order to even stay current. And so I think the biggest impact of MOOCs today is actually not on college students. Even though we work with universities, even though, you know, this is a project that I guess the five of us had launched out of a university, the biggest impact that MOOCs are having today is not on college students, it is on continuing adult education. And so I think many businesses, either individuals, the working professionals, or often the management of businesses are coming or sending others to come to Coursera to take MOOCs in order to continue to develop their employees. And I think part of that is because, you know, if you're a working professional, you often don't have time to, I don't know, it's tough to hire a babysitter twice a night, you know, twice a week in order to go back to the local community college. I mean, if you're working, you don't have very convenient access to continued education. And I think the convenience of an online class, one that you can take at home on the weekends, in your spare time, that's bringing a lot of working adults back into the educational system. So concretely, if anyone wants to learn Android programming, you know, it really didn't exist when I was in college. Probably didn't exist when most of us were in college, but it's such an important part of the computing world today. Well, University of Maryland and Vanderbilt University teach a fantastic Android programming course on Coursera. And if you want to learn about machine learning, you know, I teach a course on that. Johns Hopkins is a fantastic data science set of courses. And I think we're bringing many computing professionals and other professionals back to take more courses.
Now, you're at the forefront of all of this as a co-founder of Coursera. And you must be getting some amazing research findings now. Can you share some of that?
Yeah. So, you know, Coursera has logged so much data, right? Because every action that a learner takes is in the digital realm in Coursera, unlike in a traditional university classroom. And so we log every student action. And we are, as you can predict, mining that data in order to try to understand human learning, being very mindful of student privacy, of course. But so we learn lots of things. By now we've had like large dozens of studies done by Coursera or by our university partners. And I'll just share with you one result that maybe was surprising to me, which is that so here's one thing that we learned. It turns out that if we send you an email every week that says, you know, "Dear Stephen, friendly reminder, homework is due this Saturday," if we send you that email, you're less likely to engage the class, you're less likely to complete. Kind of spammy. But if we send you an email that says, you know, "Dear Stephen, oh, we noticed you logged in last week. Good job with that. Oh, and we noticed you did the last homework on time and you got full marks. Great job on that too. And we noticed you made 2 comments on the discussion forum and 5 other students thought that was really useful. Wow, that's great job on that. Oh, and by the way, Stephen, friendly reminder, next homework is due this Saturday." Turns out we send you that email, you're more likely to complete the course. So in hindsight, maybe it's kind of obvious that if we, you know, remind a student of what they had done well before asking for them to take the next step, that's more encouraging. But the reason, the way we discovered this was not by, was not by having that insight early on. The way we discovered this effect was one of our engineers sent tens of thousands of different email designs to, you know, hundreds of thousands of students, and then he looked at the data. He just saw that students sent, you know, email number 17 were more likely to complete than students sent any other email, and then it was only then that we then actually went back and read these emails and discovered this effect. And so I think if we had been teaching classes with 100 or 200 students, there's no way we would have discovered this. It's only because we had these hundreds of thousands of learners that we were able to, one of our engineers was able to do this. And so this is maybe just one example of the many dozens of studies that we and Coursera's university partners have done that I think are starting to, you know, allow us to more deeply understand student motivations and student learning.
Now, we've already discussed some of this already, but can you maybe add some additional sort of insight to some of your biggest challenges and controversies in this field?
Let's see. Here's the biggest controversy. I sometimes get asked, will MOOCs replace professors? That's maybe the most stark posing of the question. Will MOOCs replace professors? And what I tell people is, you know, as if you were to think about your favorite teacher, maybe if Stephen, you were to think about your favorite professor, your favorite teacher, when you were going through school, and think about the conversations you had with him or her, maybe the mentoring you had with him or her, and if I was to ask you, do you think we can replace that favorite mentor of yours with a computer? I think the answer is clearly no, and we'd be silly to even try. And I think that the reality of today's educational system is that that favorite teacher of yours is spending most of his or her time grading papers, spending most of his or her time delivering the same lecture year after year, you know, to a classroom, which is what I did for a decade at Stanford. And I think the opportunity for technology is to free up that favorite teacher of yours from these more repetitive aspects of teaching, so that they can spend even more time in the future in conversations and mentoring and coaching with students, similar just as they had perhaps with you and just as my mentors did with me. So I think that MOOCs help instructors to move up the value chain to deliver high value, more valuable services to students than, you know, like just grading homeworks and delivering the same lecture year after year.
Okay, now we're going to go to some more general questions. Can you describe your most significant and influential research achievements and then the practical outcomes seen today and then forecast it into the future?
Gosh, I don't know. I think one of the things I'm quite proud of was the fact that we launched these MOOCs, I guess. I find that as I get older, I find that I become more excited in doing work. And so I've been writing research articles less frequently with my students, but just spending more time trying to do good work. And so maybe not many people know this, but the whole world heard about MOOCs or, you know, sort of saw a lot of the coverage of MOOCs back in 2011. What not many people know was that that was one of those, you know, maybe overnight success stories that was not nearly so overnight when you were on the inside working on this. So maybe one thing I'm quite proud of, actually, So in 2011, four students and me launched the first Stanford MOOC site that had two courses, one on databases taught by Jennifer Woodham, another one by me, and then Sebastian Thurin had a separate site that hosted another class. But sitting where I was sitting, that was actually the sixth version of a website that I had built and launched. And I think what happened was, you know, version one, which I had launched in 2007, maybe each learner that came to it told 0.5 other people. And then version 2, which launched maybe like 2009, each student told, you know, 0.7 others. And then each student told 0.9 others. It was only in 2011 that each student on average told 1.1 other people. And then it went viral. And then the whole world heard about it. But it was actually many years of iterating on, you know, trying to come up with better auto rating software, iterating on the video format and how to record online videos that makes them engaging and useful to learners. I took a lot of inspiration from Sal Khan in the format of the videos. Sal Khan of Khan Academy for the format of videos. But it was really through those 4 or 5 years of iterating that in 2011 we were able to launch two of the first MOOCs. And then after we saw the success of the first few MOOCs, I wound up recruiting, you know, a number of other Stanford faculty to join me in teaching these courses. And one of them, of course, was my very good friend Daphne Collar that wound up joining the four students and me, and we wound up starting Coursera. I think I in the early days, it was literally me in my living room with no budget and like a cheap webcam. Spent a long time figuring this out. So I'm very proud of that. I guess I'm also very proud of the deep learning work that my students and that my Google team had done. It was really teamwork. I feel like because of my role, I tend to get outsized credit, you know, for a lot of the things that was really the work of my students or the work of my teammates at Google. But I think that both the economic impact that the you know, deep learning can have at Google, as well as the ideas on supervised and unsupervised learning that that the research community has generated, of which I was maybe a small part. I'm very excited about that. And I'm also, as I said earlier, I'm just super excited about the potential of unsupervised deep learning to help us finally make progress in perception. And this is something I spent a lot of time thinking about. And then maybe one last thing. You asked about robots just now, but one thing I didn't mention is that my Stanford students and I have been spending a lot of time looking at building self-driving cars using deep learning algorithms. I think that could be another economically important application. And still a lot of work to do, but you know, making decent progress so far.
Now, you've shared a lot about the different kinds of research you've done, and maybe you can generalize a bit in terms of what you see as the most difficult challenges in research in general, and then sort of lessons that you can pass on to the audience.
I recently did a pretty brutal exercise of going through, looking at all the projects I had ever worked on, and making a list of all the projects that had failed, the projects that, in hindsight, I maybe wish I hadn't started, or that we spent a ton of time on, but that wound up with relatively little to show for it. And it turns out that almost all the projects that failed, it was my fault. It was never a student's fault. It was often that, you know, I had made poor choices in the strategy or just in the directions that we're choosing to execute a research project. So maybe let me share with you just the way I think about research projects now, I guess, which is, I often ask myself, if you were to take whatever you're working on, and if you were to succeed beyond your wildest dreams, would anyone care? And I think that, and the way I think about projects is I often, you know, allow myself to make optimistic assumptions. Like, if you were to assume that everything you do goes reasonably well, make optimistic but sensible assumptions. And if you were to assume, you know, everything you do goes well, you do another thing goes well, do another thing goes well, at the end of a year or 2 years or 5 years, is what you have accomplished something that would have a significant impact on the world? And if the answer isn't a resounding yes, then, you know, I would usually try to find something else to work on. So in hindsight, I think in my previous lives, I've actually started a few projects that even if they had gone well, I wasn't sure what was the significant impact they would have had on the world. And looking back now, I think that if I can't tell myself a story for how something could change the world, then, you know, I'm just much less inclined to work on that now. And then maybe a second piece of advice to people doing research is another lens that I use to think about research is research of all the disciplines we work in is a space in which we really don't know what we're doing, right? If we knew what we're doing, it wouldn't really be research. And does your ability to succeed in a project, be it build self-driving cars or build deep learning system or build a platform for online education or revolutionize biology or whatever you're working on. If it's research, then your speed of learning is very important. And so your ability to succeed on most of these projects will, to a large extent, be determined by your ability to try things quickly, get data back, and learn and iterate. And so one of the books that has influenced my thinking a lot is a book on called The Lean Startup by Eric Ries, Eric R-I-E-S, I think is the spelling. And this is a philosophy to building startup companies, but it's a philosophy that I think applies well to research projects as well, where I think there is a certain emphasis not on laying out grandiose, you know, multi-year plans that have huge assumptions and huge risks and may or may not ever come to fruition, but an emphasis on staying humble and running experiments like crazy and learning and iterating, because very often, you know, the shock and awe surprises, right, when you see that someone has some amazing groundbreaking result, the stuff that looks like it took off overnight probably was a lot of incremental work that was done over long periods of time. And I think that at the heart of doing that incremental work is just the ability to sit there and plug and chug and try things out and learn from it. Certainly for the launch of Coursera, that's what it felt like from the inside when I spent years actually in my living room recording videos and getting feedback from students and figuring out that, you know, I should use this software and not that software, and was only many years of doing that allowed us to launch the two of the first MOOCs in 2011. And I see something similar, that I think we should have a grand plan. We should have some idea of where we're going. If this stuff works well, then maybe in 5 years or 10 years we can get to this great result. But when you think about what happens actually in the day to day over those 5 years or 10 years, I think a lot of it is little pieces of day to day learning. And the faster you can learn, the faster you will make progress in research, because I think fundamentally research is learning about the unknown.
You know, it's an interesting sort of answer to the question, and especially on the Eric Ries's work on the lean startups, and I guess then you're using the philosophy of a minimal viable product in terms of your development, and I guess that then goes to Steve Blank and his customer development philosophy. and Alexander Osterwalder and his business model canvas. So I'm assuming then you're incorporating all of that in your business as well as in your research.
I personally been influenced a lot by the set of ideas you named, somewhat more so by the lean startup set of ideas than the business canvas set of ideas. But I think, you know, I think the latter has influenced my thinking as well. And maybe, you know, one philosophy, I sometimes students at Stanford will ask me for advice about what to work on and how to think about, you know, how to structure their careers or what projects to work on. And one lens I often use to that I advise that I myself actually, this is how I actually choose what to do, is a combination of two things. One is impact on the world. I think we all want to make the world a better place. It's why I work on deep learning. It's why I work at Coursera. So that's really important. But the second is also whether or not the project or the work gives you an opportunity to learn. I think that, you know, so I'm 37. I hope that I'll be around for quite a few more years. And so I think that for those of us that plan to keep working for many years to come, our ability to learn and get better will have a huge impact on what we will be able to accomplish in the, you know, let's say in the remainder of our lives. And so when I look at some of the people, maybe some of the people in academia or in industry that I most admire, one almost universal characteristic of the people I most admire, you know, like, I don't know, like Jeff Hinton, you know, Michael Jordan, my advisor, or leaders in Silicon Valley like Larry Page. One enduring characteristic of the people that I most admire is that they kept getting better over time. Like the Jeff Hinton of today knows so much more than the Jeff Hinton of like 10 years ago, and knows so much more than the Jeff Hinton of 20 years ago. And so I myself, and I hope that all of us in this technical community will keep on leveling ourselves up and keep on getting better.
Now, on this next question, it's going to be sort of addressed to young people who are in the audience, and that, you know, what are the sort of burning challenges and research problems that you would advise today's youth to solve and then to inspire them to go into computing in some way?
Yeah, so let's see. I think that this is why I'm a computer scientist. I think that computer science is fundamentally about scale. I think that there are many professions that, you know, individuals could choose to go into, and there are few disciplines as scalable as engineering or as computer science specifically. And what I mean by that is that if you become a house painter, right, and you paint a house, that house might be enjoyed by a family of four. Right. And, you know, I'm very grateful to whoever painted my house. I'm very happy with the color the walls are and so on. But if you paint a house and it affects four people, that's just not that scalable. Your work affects a relatively small number of individuals. And also have a greatest admiration for, you know, even doctors. My father's a doctor. I'm very grateful to my doctors for caring for me, you know, when I had a cold or when I was sick. But if you see patients, you know, you can see a limited number of patients, and if you work 10 times as hard, maybe you can see 10 times as many patients, but it is not clear that that scales. Computer science is unique in that you can write a piece of software and a million people could be using your piece of software the next day. And this gets only, and with the internet, with faster networks, you know, the ability to scale your work is only growing. And with developing economies coming online, I think, and so computer science is this discipline where if you do good work, it gives you the opportunity to touch millions of people in a relatively short time. And I think that if your aspiration is to, you know, make the world a better place, have a huge impact on the world, I think this technology, this computing, offers tremendous potential for that. And also, in terms of the, you know, personal rewards, financial rewards, or the accolades or whatever that accrue back to the individual, if you're able to move, right, tens or hundreds of thousands or millions of people in the world and make their lives better, often the rewards that accrue to the individual will be tremendously greater as well. So I think computer science fundamentally lets you scale, and that's why I'm excited about being a computer scientist. And, you know, and as for problems to work on, boy, there's so many problems. I personally like working on AI because I think there's a huge potential there to uplift the human race. But I think computing is, data computing is so pervasive. And, if you are a computer scientist, if you have the set of superpowers to write software that others can use and love, few days ago, chatting with Sam Hinkie, the general manager of 76ers, and they're building out a data analytics team, to do analytics for the 76ers, the basketball team. And they're doing actually some really clever work. And so, I mean, everything from CompBio to online education to big companies like Google and Baidu to something that you might not even think of, like a basketball team. Computer science is impacting so many ideas. I hope more people will join me to work on AI, but even outside AI, I think the ability of computer science to change the world is almost unlimited.
Now, there's a number of organizations out there. One of them is the ACM, and it has a number of resources. So how has the ACM and its resources supported your research?
Yeah, so actually, I'm a proud lifetime member of the ACM, and I always look forward to receiving the ACM newsletter in the new ACM magazine in the mail and flipping through that in order to have another channel to learn about the latest computing trends. I think that I've been grateful to the ACM for the events organizers for bringing the technical community together. I think that we face so many challenges as a community of technical computing professionals, and ACM and the CRA really have been the hubs that keep on bringing us together to help us be a community rather than a set of individuals doing our individual things.
Now, I know you're heavily scheduled, so we're going to sort of get down to our last few questions here. In a broader way, if you look beyond, let's say the computing, or even including the computing field, what do you see as the top challenges facing us, and do you have any ways that could be solved?
Top challenges facing us. I think our planet faces a lot of challenges. I think that global poverty, inequality, are some of the major challenges facing our society. I think one thing I've been very fortunate to do is, even as I've been at Stanford, even as I worked at Coursera, worked at these fantastic places, for whatever reason, I've been fortunate to still have had contact with some of the less fortunate members of our society. And when I see the daily struggles of, it's kind of a quick personal story. When we were just starting Coursera, Daphne had joined me at the time, but when we were just launching Coursera, I was at a party here in Silicon Valley, and a group of friends, and after almost everyone had left, it was one friend and me sitting on the floor chatting, and in the course of that conversation, my friend started taking out her wallet and counting $10 and $20 bills on the floor to see if she could scrape together $500 to pay for her tuition at the local community college. This was one of my friends, it's someone that I care deeply about, and it's a pretty jarring image to see your friend counting $10, $20 bills to see if they could scrape together $500. And I think that those of us that work in computing, I think that is important for us to, develop and to maintain an empathy for the needier people in our society so that we can come up with solutions, so that we can work on developing things that will benefit those less fortunate members of our society, both in the U.S. and outside the U.S. But I think that even in the wealthiest areas, I think there are so many people scraping to make ends meet. This is why I work at Coursera. I think we have a potential to help with all of these people, but it's not enough. I think we have orphans, we have missing children, we have developing economies with barely internet access, And I hope that I hope that many computer scientists will, you know, step up and use our superpowers of computing in order to try to develop the world into a better place, into a more equal place for all of these people.
Now, I'm going to turn the tables, and this is going to be either my last question or next to last, and that is, if you were conducting this interview, what questions would you have asked, and then what would be your answers?
I think that if I were an interviewer, I would have been fired from the job long ago. I'm glad I'm just a computer programmer. I'm glad I just work on EdTech and AI and don't get to do interviews like these. I it's embarrassing, but I think you've asked such great questions that I'm actually drawing a blank.
Okay, so I'll ask one more question then, and this question is, you know, you're just a celebrated professional. You've done so much as a scientist, as a researcher, as a founder, entrepreneur. You've had major impact. You've won many, many awards, and I encourage the audience to look at your profile. It's just an amazing profile. And so you've had an opportunity to travel a lot and to see a lot of things around the world. Are there any sort of stories you want to share? Maybe something amazing or surprising or unexpected?
Yeah. Let me share a story in a second. Let me just speak a little bit to the first part of that. Actually, I mean, thank you for the compliments. But, you know, I feel, just being totally truthful, I feel very strongly that a lot of this outsized credit I seem to get for the projects associated with me, it really wasn't just me. It was always teamwork. The first MOOCs, I worked with many students over many years to develop the ideas, but then it was 4 students that wrote all the software. At Stanford, when we fly helicopters, it was really Adam Coates and Peter Abiel students doing all the work. And at Google, it was teamwork. And at Coursera today, there are like 102 of us, and I'm just frankly one person that does some things, but only a very small fraction of what Coursera as a company does today. So I actually feel, I'm somewhat, I continue to be somewhat mystified at the outsized credit I seem to get, and I hope that people realize that all of these things, it's always teamwork. In many cases, my students or collaborators or teammates were the ones that did, frankly, much more work than I did. But for whatever reason, I sometimes end up the figurehead and getting outsized credit. But I'm always a little bit discomforted with with the outsized credit that I sometimes seem to get. But thank you for those comments. Maybe just one fun story. I think that I feel honored that when we launched the first MOOCs in out of Stanford, that these, what, some, you know, 100,000 students took it, 13,000 finished, and it's offered multiple times, but 500,000 learners, 500,000 enrollments in my machine learning MOOC. And this causes people to have an interesting impression of me. So it turns out that one of the favorite features of MOOCs on Coursera is the ability to play videos back at, 2x speed, right? So if you think I talk to, if you want to blaze through the machine learning videos that I teach, you can play all the videos at 2x speed, and because if you miss something, you can just do an instant replay. So a few months ago, I was at a party at LinkedIn here in Silicon Valley, and I met one of the students that had taken my machine learning MOOC, and he came up to me and he said, "Oh, are you right? You must be Professor Andrew Moon." And he said, "One of the features I most liked," he said to me, "was, you know, the ability to play videos at 2x speed, because it allowed him to blaze through the video, and if you miss something, you just do an instant replay." But he said to me, he said, "You know, Professor Ng, now that I've watched like 20 hours of videos of you talking, and all of these videos were of you talking at 2x speed, now that I meet you in person, I'm really surprised that in person, you talk so slow." So it's always fun to meet the students that have been taking my MOOC or taking other Coursera courses, but quite a few of them have been surprised at how slowly I talk in person.
Yeah, that's a good story. It's That's me smiling. So, Andrew, you know, thank you for coming in today. And I know you've got to go off to another meeting right away. So, I'm, you know, we're indeed fortunate you came in to share your many views and wisdom with our audience. So, again, thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Stephen.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Andrew Ng, co-founder of Coursera, director of Stanford Artificial Intelligence Lab, and a world-renowned, top-ranking, distinguished researcher, innovator, and entrepreneur.